I think we're going to go ahead and start. Good morning and welcome to this symposium session on innovative approaches to increasing access to HIV care prevention and treatment among TB patients. I think over the past few days we've heard about progress we've made internationally in scaling up HIV testing and counseling, but time and time again we see that when the linkage is made of referring patients from TB clinics to HIV care and prevention treatment, there's a drop-off in the cascade, and patients are getting lost in the process. So the objective of the session is to highlight some innovative approaches that are being implemented in countries and also have some discussion and share across countries. So. And as far as the format, I think we're going to have each of the presenters give their talks and allow for about 5 minutes of clarification and then have some longer in-depth discussion towards the end of the session. So I'm Monita Patel with CDC Atlanta, and I'll be co-chairing, and I'll let my co-chair introduce himself.
My name is Rehab Chimzizi, Management Science for Health, Ghana. So our first presenter this morning, I think, as you see from the list, the first presenter is not available. So the second one will be the one presenting, but you would see the name is Joseph Onyango, but the one presenting is Dr. Joseph Odhiambo. Dr. Joseph Odhiambo is a senior technical advisor, GAP Nairobi. I think Dr. Joseph Odhiambo is a well-known doctor in TB-HIV, so I think he's going to give us experience from Kenya. Over to you, Dr. Odhiambo.
I'll press this once. Is it okay? Mm-hmm. Shall I press it again?
One more time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Firstly, allow me to thank the Congress organizers most sincerely for inviting me to speak here today. I'm going to share with you the role of community treatment supporters in providing and linking TB patients to HIV prevention care and treatment in Kenya. Now, HIV testing for TB patients is now the standard of care in Kenya. As we all know, this is an essential step to life-saving HIV interventions for co-infected patients. TB and HIV programs in high-burden settings face many challenges that include staff shortages, inadequate resources, poor infrastructure, and weak linkages between the TB and HIV services. We report here Kenya's experience with community TB treatment supporters, and we call them TB ambassadors in providing and linking TB patients to HIV services in Nyanza province of Western Kenya. What are the policy and programmatic context of these activities? Kenya, some 5 years ago, piloted a community input in TB control activities and established that the approach was acceptable, feasible, and cost-effective, and this has been published, the lead author being Joel Kangangi. The Kenya National TB Control Program adopted the community-based TB DOTS strategy in the year 2002. And more recently, the Kenya Ministry of Health, a community health strategy, advocates strongly for the role of the community volunteers in provision of primary health care. Now, just give you some orientation to Nyanza in Kenya. Nyanza is situated in the western part of Kenya, on the shores of Lake Victoria. Nyanza has a population of about 5 million, compared to Kenya, 36 million. So the population of Nyanza is about 15% of the national population. Nyanza registered in excess of 23,000 TB cases at the end of last year, giving a case a notification rate of about 440 per 100,000 population. Nyanza province contributes 20% of the national burden of TB and 31% of the national burden of HIV. So it is an area with high burden for both TB and HIV. Nyanza has some 346 TB clinics, 100 of which double as TB diagnostic points. And Nyanza is served at the moment by about 100 ART clinics. Now, to initiate this activity, TB district TB coordinators, in collaboration with CDC and the Kenya Medical Research Institute, launched the community-based TB dots strategy in four districts. That is Siaya, Bondo in 2004, followed by Nyandor and Kisumu 2 years later. Now, Nyanza province consists of 12 districts, so the four districts are among the high burden districts within Nyanza province. So we chose 14 high volume facilities in Siaya and 10 from each of the other three districts, that's Bondo, Nyando, and Kisumu, giving a total of 44 facilities. Between 30 and 35 community TB ambassadors were selected through consensus at local chief's baraza to cover each facility. A chief's baraza in Kenya is the lowest governance entity for coordination of social welfare of the community. So in the community, one TB ambassador covered 1 to 3 villages. Each village is about 100,000, or rather 1,000 people within the facility catchment area. Just gives you some sense of the distribution of the community TB ambassador sites. At the center is the Siaya town, and in blue are the major divisions in Siaya, and this is just gives you some sense of the distribution of the location of the sites that being served by the TB ambassadors. Now, the TB ambassadors were selected based on certain criteria. Firstly, they were volunteers willing to offer about 6 hours per week for this activity. They needed to be literate and were local permanent residents of these areas, and the community had to establish that they were of good moral conduct. And if they had previous community services, this was a plus for their selection, and these people had to be community accepted. Thereafter, after the selection, they received 4 days of training based on a curriculum that was developed jointly by the Ministry of Health, the Kenya Medical Research Institute, and CDC. This 4 days training was non-residential, but had several contents. The ambassadors got familiarity with the TB symptoms and signs, how TB is treated, adherence counseling, the side effects of the TB drugs, the link between TB and HIV, recording and reporting arrangements on nutrition, on communication skills, and on default tracing. Then the ambassadors were given to understand their roles, which were to deliver TB, HIV information, education, and communication messages, identify and refer TB suspects, and supervise a family direct therapy of treatment, trace and follow up treatment defaulters, and escort TB patients to HIV clinics. They also multitask in the sense that they took up responsibilities like filing, cleaning, and adherence counseling. Now, the community TB ambassadors were answerable to their group coordinators, who prepared monthly summary reports for facility heads. The facility heads were mainly senior nursing officers, clinical officers, and in some situations, public health technicians. The facility heads, in turn, prepared reports that were submitted to the district TB coordinators. This is just a short of some of the education meetings being led by the TB ambassadors. What are some of our experiences? Now, we trained a total of 2,259 TB ambassadors across the four districts. And as of the moment, the majority of them are still active. For Siaya, we have in excess of 500, for Bondo, 389, and we didn't quite have the figures for Nyando and Kisumu. But what we wanted to show here is that over the years, we have had reasonably good retention rate for these TB ambassadors. So for Siaya, we have had dropouts of only 10%, similarly for Bondo District. Now, Nyanza Province in 2007 reported in excess of 23,000 TB patients. Now, the four districts contribute about half of the Nyanza TB burden, 44%, that is 10,318. Now, for the whole province, our TB ambassadors referred some 7%, 1,620. But the majority of their contribution, obviously, was in the districts where they were operating. So for the four districts, they contributed 12% of the TB referrals. That's 1,232 for the four districts. Now, what were the contributions of our ambassadors to TB services in Siaya and Bondo districts? For the two districts, we had a total of 2,224 TB suspects that were referred, and out of this, for Siaya district, we had 280, and that's nearly 30% of the referrals were confirmed to have TB. For Bondo, nearly half of them were, in excess of half of them were confirmed to have tuberculosis. So close to 50% of the overall TB referrals for the two districts were confirmed to have TB. Now, for the two districts, Siaya and Bondo, we had 127 TB defaulters traced for Siaya district and about 400 for Bondo districts. I'll talk a little bit more about these defaulters for Siaya shortly. Now, for Siaya, over the year 2007 and also over the last one half of this year, Siaya registered a total of 2,127 TB patients. Out of this, 280 or 13% were diagnosed through the referrals of the TB ambassadors. Out of 1,061 referrals by the TB ambassadors, 280 were confirmed to have active disease and constituted part of this 2,127 cases registered for Siaya. Now, for Siaya too, out of 146 documented TB defaulters, 127 were successfully traced by the TB ambassadors. Here's a situation where our own TB program has a weakness in this area because we don't have sufficient hands to kind of trace our TB defaulters. So the TB ambassadors came readily to bridge this gap. For Bondo, out of 96 TB defaulters, the TB ambassadors traced more than half of them. Now, how were their activities monitored? The TB ambassadors used referral cheats given to the TB suspects. And they used these cheats to kind of assess TB diagnostic services of the nearest health facilities within which the ambassadors operated. They had diaries in which they recorded the adherence activities for the patients they were serving. They did home visits and other community activities. All these were recorded in their diaries. Now, out of the various reports, these were kind of aggregated by the group coordinators in monthly summary reports, and the group coordinators in turn returned this to the facility supervisors, who in turn consolidated their reports for the district TB coordinators. Now, the TB coordinators, the district TB coordinators, entered all the records of TB cases in the formal TB registered for the facilities as well as the central TB registers for the districts. What lessons did we learn through the interactions with the community TB ambassadors? We learned that motivation through training and recognition of their important roles, or we witnessed very low dropout rates, only 10% in CIA and Bondo districts. Through the use of TB ambassadors, generated significant numbers of active TB cases that were registered through these activities. Thirdly, we had significant numbers of TB treatment defaulters that were traced through the activity of our TB ambassadors. Our impression is that the role of community TB ambassadors offer a vital link between the facilities and the community level TB and HIV services and constitute an important and underutilized resource in high burden settings like Kenya. And therefore, this is an important response to the Kenya's community-based DOT strategy. You may wonder what proportion of the TB patients identified through this initiative actually accessed HIV services. I don't have the actual numbers, but the following is a good guidance. In excess of 80% of our TB patients get an HIV test. So in excess of 80% of the TB patients that were identified through this activity were HIV tested. In excess of 90% of our HIV positive TB patients access cotrimoxazole. So in excess of 90% of the TB patients identified through this initiative gotten access to cotrimoxazole. We have about 30% of HIV positive TB patients accessing ART. At this moment in time, it's possible that this number is slightly larger than this one because we don't have a fairly good tracking system between HIV and TB services. But the majority of our TB patients are actually eligible for ART. Some of them may not necessarily be on ART because they have high CD4 levels or for some other reason. So we hope that it is possible for this initiative to be expanded in the rest of Nyanza so that we get more TB cases and hopefully brought to national scale because community DOT strategy is a national strategy. And we hope also that other parts of Africa where we have high burdens of TB and HIV and we may not have sufficient hands to take care of the services. We hope that the lessons we have learned here may be useful to the other parts of Africa. Thank you very much for your attention. I would like to acknowledge the following, my colleagues in CDC, as well as our Minister of Health colleagues, Felix Onyango of FHI, all our community TB ambassadors, and lastly, the Minister of Health and CDC through PEFRA for technical and financial support. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Odhiambo. I think it shows how we can use the community to help us in our TB control. And actually what I liked was the use of the name ambassadors. I think the community are actually now tired of being called volunteers. Probably the catch thing, probably you have called them ambassadors. So maybe that's why maybe you're achieving results. We know that I think at the end we have discussion, but probably you may have a quick clarification to ask Dr. Odhiambo, maybe one or two. But at the end of the day, we have discussions. Can you come to the mic or the other one there?
Thank you for a very good presentation. I'm Temitayo Odushote from USAID Nigeria. Do you pay the ambassadors? I mean, what kind of incentives do you give them? That was a whole lot of training, and they seem to be fairly dedicated. Or is it that they're actively involved in other community-based programs, and this is just an add-on?
So we don't pay them. They are volunteers, and the real motivation is that we train them, and they are recognized by the community and accepted by the community. And the other thing is that their roles are accepted as valuable to the community. So they are not paid in cash.
Do they have other jobs? Are they doing this part-time?
They are doing this part-time. That's why they volunteer 6 hours per week. 6 hours per week for their activities.
Good. Other motivation, they are called ambassadors, not volunteers.
Okay.
Dr. Mir, you wanted to ask something?
Okay. Yeah, actually, I wanted to go to the same point. Have you considered paying them? And maybe this is for the after discussion, the whole issue of ambassadors or whatever. I'm wondering for retention and just for strengthening the community that maybe we could discuss later the issue of whether these folks should be paid.
Sure.
Hello.
Okay, the last one.
Okay. I think my question has actually been answered on the incentive, but I beg to disagree with the last speaker that they should be paid. I'm part of an initiative like that in Nigeria called Civil Society Network for Volunteering Development. And this seeks to develop volunteers to address major development issues, especially health. And this is just one of that. And I tell you sincerely that the motivation for volunteers is not that cash. And it is what you have identified, the trainings, certificate for trainings, opportunities to come to conferences like this. Maybe for the next one, you can bring one or two of them to share their experiences. These are the things that motivate volunteers. I've been volunteering all my life for over 15 years also, you know, with organizations. And they have even offered me to work with them. I mean, this is a big organization. And I said, no, I prefer to work with you as a volunteer and retain that position and that independency. And it has really worked. So that is our motivation, and it's not the cash. So I want you to keep that program that way. But one thing I want to add to that is there's something we call volunteer management training. If you can add that component, it will help you also to maximize the potentials of these volunteers. Thank you.
Thank you for excellent contribution.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Odhiambo. Our next presenter is Dr. Wandwalo. Dr. Wandwalo is a TB-HIV focal point person in the National TB Control Program Tanzania. Dr. Wandwalo has published quite a lot of papers and is not new in the TB-HIV arena. So welcome, Dr. Wandwalo.
Thank you, Rehab. I would like to thank the organizers of this symposium for inviting us to share our experience on provision of antiretroviral drugs to patients within TB clinic. First, I would like to acknowledge my colleagues whom we have worked together to set up this TB ART provision within TB clinic. And indeed, I would like also to thank many of our partners whom we have worked together to scale up collaborative TB-HIV activity in the country. This is an overview of my presentation. I'll start giving the background to collaborative TB-HIV activities in the country, and then discuss a bit why we decided to use this model of providing ART within TB clinic. I'll highlight some of the achievement of this model, the challenges, and then I'll finish up with some of the lessons we have learned through this process. The background to TB-HIV collaborative activities in the country is really due to the rising number of TB patients in the country, and indeed in most of the sub-Saharan countries because of the HIV epidemic. We experienced a very rapid increase of TB patients, especially in the late 90s and early 2000 because of the HIV. And it was estimated that in the country, about 60% of the increase of the TB patients is really due to HIV epidemic, as you can see here. We conducted two surveys in the country to look at the prevalence of HIV among TB patients. The last one was done more than 10 years ago, and it showed that about 44% of all TB patients by then were co-infected with HIV, and the picture has not changed since then. The number we are getting from the routine data is about 40 to 50%. And you could see that there's a wide regional variation within the country. There are regions where about 70% of all TB patients have already been infected with HIV. Due to this problem, we decided to start collaborative TB-HIV activity, and we started as a pilot project in three districts in 2005. And we did an evaluation of these sites, and we found that most of the TB patients were agreeing to be tested for HIV, about 80% of them in these pilot sites, and majority were referred to care and treatment clinics for care and services, and some were accessing ART and also cotrimoxazole. At the same time, when we are busy starting TB collaborative HIV activities, another big development was happening, which really gave momentum to the whole TB-HIV collaborative activity, and that was the initiation of ART antiretroviral treatment program in the country. This started in 2004. And at that time, it was estimated that there were more than 400,000 people in the country who would require ART among the estimated 2 million people who are living with HIV. And by August this year, the ART program was decentralized and then scaled up to more than 200 sites in the country. And this is mainly in the district hospital, regional hospital, and major hospital among around 5,000 health facilities in the country. And by August, also, it was the number of people who were on care and treatment services were about 360,000, and about 169,000 people were on ART. That is by August this year. With regard to collaborative TB-HIV activity, we started scaling up these activities in the early 2006, and we started in 10 districts. And by first quarter of 2006, about 4% of all TB patients in the country were tested for HIV. But we made a big progress. And by June this year, about 81% of all TB patients in the country were tested for HIV. And collaborative TB-HIV activity have been scaled up in all 132 districts in the country. Now, I would like to give you the context of a clinic where we started this pilot project to provide ART within TB clinic. This clinic is in Dar es Salaam, in Temeke district, which is one of the three districts of the Dar es Salaam city, which is a capital business town in the country. Temeke has a population of about 9,100 people, and TB notification in that area is very high. It's three times the national average. HIV prevalence is about 7.5%, and TB HIV co-infection is about 44%. This clinic where we started providing ART within TB clinic is one among 37 other TB clinics in Temeke Municipal. And ART is provided in about 4 sites in the district. And why did we decide to provide ART within TB clinic? The first and I think the most important reason was poor referral of patients from TB clinic to the HIV clinic, CTC clinic, and many patients were not reaching CTC. Due to that, many patients, we had a low proportion of TB HIV patients who were starting ARV. But another big reason was congestion on the overburden of the care and treatment clinics. In Temeke, by then, when we started this model, it was estimated that about 15,000 people were requiring ART, and there was only one public care and treatment clinic. So this clinic, we are seeing more than 300 patients a day. But again, this was also need-driven from the patients, because when we told the patient that they should be tested for HIV within TB clinic, most required to get the ARV there. So it was a demand coming from patients, and they thought that why do you want to start providing HIV services and you then refer us to go to another clinic to get ARV? And also there was worry among most of our health workers that probably, sending especially very infectious TB patients to CTC to start ARV maybe would infect most of the patients at a CTC clinic who had HIV. This is data from Temeke just before we started providing ART, and you could see most patients were agreeing to be tested, and majority were referred from TB clinic to CTC, about 96%, but you could see only 16% of them we are really accessing ARV. So, and also about a third of the patients who were referred from TB clinic were really registered at CTC. So majority of patients were not reaching CTC. So the objective of our ART clinic in TB clinic was first of all to provide services, all service, one-stop shop. We call it supermarket. So we stretch a little bit this concept of two diseases, one patient, one response, and we added one roof. So we wanted to really provide everything there. But of course, the main reason was really to increase access of care and treatment to these patients. And we thought that it was good to test patients, but if you test many patients and they are not accessing treatment, we thought it was not optimal. So that was an attempt really to increase patients on the care and treatment. And of course, another reason was also to reduce delays and inconveniences to the patients to go to two separate clinics to get the same treatment. So what did we do? The first prerequisite for starting ART is really to have basic TB HIV services. Although the main reason was really because of the poor referral system, but if you really want to start an ARV clinic within TB clinic, you need to have very good collaboration between the two clinics. That means to be between the TB and HIV, because this TB clinic will be like an extension of CTC. So you'll need reagents, you'll need drugs, so you need to have a very good collaboration between these two services. So with this basic TB HIV activity, you need to train health workers, and we establish the basic diagnostic and counseling services, and then you need to have very good reporting and recording system. So this were prerequisites to start the ARV clinic. But the main three inputs which we did, first was the infrastructure for provision of ART. The second one was human resource, increase the number and quality of health workers within TB clinic, and of course the other one was training. With regard to the infrastructure, this is the clinic in Temeke, and this is another clinic, another TB clinic. I couldn't get the previous picture before we did renovation, but this is typify most of the TB clinics, not only in Temeke, but in our country, and I think in most sub-Saharan countries. Mostly, it's a one-room building and a very small space for patients to sit, and you need to transform this. Because this one, you can't provide ART, and not only ART, but even TB HIV, basic TB HIV services, because you need a place for counseling, testing, registration, and so forth. So we did renovation for this clinic, and this is a renovated clinic in TB in Temeke. And what we did, we increased the number of rooms. Previously, we had 3 rooms, and we increased the number of rooms to 7, and additional rooms were required for consultation, for counseling, testing, registration, and data management, and drug administration to the patient. So this is one of the rooms which we did renovation. As you can see here, it's comfortable for a clinician to provide counseling and testing, and also for consultation. Another important input was human resource. Previously, the clinic had about 3 staff, one clinician who was also a district TB coordinator, a nurse, and a nurse attendant. So we increased the number of staff from 3 to 7. So we had additional 2 nurses for counseling and testing, recording and reporting, and a clinician to provide ART and clinical care. And also we had one pharmacy assistant for drug management. Of course, this is additional to about 1,300 TB patients who are coming to this clinic per year. Of course, training was important, especially training for clinicians on ART provision, adherence counseling, recording and reporting, linkages with home-based care and other services, and of course also on-job training on how to transfer patients once they finish their TB treatment to CTC to continue for their ART services. So what were our main achievements? Of course, we achieved to establish one-stop shop for TB-HIV patients. We reduce inconvenience to the patients, and this was revealed by, you know, when you talk to the patients. The issue of infection control measure, we are not sure because we have not ascertained this, but I think the issue which needs to be investigated, but we think we have been able to reduce that. But more important, we have increased access to of ART among TB HIV patients. I can show this is the data for 2007. If you compare, these are the TB HIV patients for the whole country. This is Temeke, other clinics, and this is ART clinic. And you could see that although the number of patients, proportion of patients who are getting ARV has increased in other parts which are not providing ART within TB clinic because of the vigorous training, and also we have deployed people we call TB HIV officers in every district who are responsible to make sure patients are reporting. But the number, the proportion of patients who are getting ARV within TB clinic was higher, was above 42%. So I think that was a major achievement from 16% before we started this model. Of course, we have challenges, and there are challenges when you want to establish this model. One of the challenges is really infrastructure. You need there's an upfront investment for this. The renovation we did for the TB clinic was costly, and now we have started also doing in other districts, which are very costly, in the tune of 30,000 to 50,000, you know, really constructing these clinics. The issue of human resources is a challenge, and we know this is a problem in most African countries, particularly in Tanzania. So this is another challenge to establish this kind of clinics, and of course training. Another issue is really coordination and harmonization with HIV and care and treatment in terms of logistics, because as I said before, this is an extension of CTC. So you need to have very good coordination. You need to accredit it as a CTC so that you should be able to get basic services. You should be able to get mentoring from CTC and also supervision and, training. And, of course, you should be able to work out modalities of transferring patients once they finish their basic TB treatment to CTC. Another challenge we are facing, and I think it's still a challenge, is that although we have established this type of clinic, still most patients are not accessing their ARVs. According to the national guidelines in Tanzania, patients who have TB-HIV patients with CD4 below 200 count, they are supposed to start ART, of course, as early as 2 weeks after they've started their TB treatment. And also patients with CD4 between 350 and 200, they are also supposed to start their ARV at least 2 months after start their treatment. And our analysis of CD4 count among patients in Temeke shows that about 85% of the patients should be eligible to start their ARV. But even with the ART clinic, we have about 42%, so it's almost half of that. And there are many reasons for that. Of course, there was reluctance among doctors to start ARV among these patients. Of course, this is an issue which is still under investigation, when is an appropriate time to start ARV among TB patients. But also, there's a belief among patients that it's not okay to start ARV when you are taking TB treatment. And we did an anthropological study in Temeke, and many patients that if you think that if you combine TB and ARV treatment, you might die. And they've seen some people dying. So it's a myth, I don't know. It's a belief which is there in the community. And some think these drugs are very toxic, so it's better to wait. Both TB and HIV drugs are toxic drugs, so it's better to wait. You finish TB treatment and then you take ARV. So this has been one of the limitations. So we need really to educate our patients so that they should start their ARV early, because most die very early when they come to the TB treatment. So
you should be winding.
Thanks. What are some of the lessons we learned? First, we have learned that providing ART within TB clinics really improve access, as we have seen. Of course, we have been able to reduce inconveniences and delays among our patients. Issue of infection control is yet to be investigated. But initiating this type of clinics require upfront initial investment. And we think for us, it's ideal in a busy clinics or in areas where there's no CTC. And we have started scaling up this type of ART provision in other clinics. At the end of this year, we'll have 15 of them in different districts in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wandwalo. I think very good presentation. I think when you look at many countries, I think the uptake of HIV testing among TB patients is going up. The uptake of contraceptives is going up. But I think the major challenge is actually putting these HIV-positive TB patients on ART. Probably maybe the best way is to go through the one roof. But I think when you look at this, is actually the TB infection control. We need guidance from the group of Dr. Mira. How do we go about the one roof with the TB infection control? Can we take a quick two questions, clarifications, before we move to another presentation? Prof. Sanponi, and then Dr. Oh, there's already, yeah, you can start. We're already on the mic.
Okay, my name is Jared Kabeda from the program unit, management unit of TB CAP at KNCB. Thank you very much for sharing this experience, because I think there has been a lot of theoretical discussion, and it's good to see this being done in practice. One thing I probably might have it, but what I'm missing is, do you have outcome of co-infected patients who were treated with ART in this program? Because I think it can be a very good data to show how much it can improve mortality, say, compared to referring patients to other settings. And also, within your own program, you have about 66% under 200 CD4 count. So it's also good to see how far you can go before you start ART. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, we were supposed to do that comprehensive analysis of our patient before this meeting, but due to some problems, we couldn't. But we are planning to do that, really analyzing patients who started and with their CD4 count, their outcome, and maybe next year we'll be able to present that one.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for an excellent presentation. My name is Joseph Odhiambo from Kenya. We are thinking about doing a similar kind of initiative in Kenya, and I think that you provide very important lessons. I just wanted to refer you to a recent report from South Africa that indicated that there are probably better treatment outcomes if ART is started during TB treatment compared to a situation where this is started after TB treatment. I don't know whether you have come across that report. So it would kind of be in line with that if it is true. But what I wanted to ask is about the timing of initiation of ART, given that we have various levels of CD4. There's one group of patients that where there is severe immunosuppression, and you would need to initiate ART as well as TB for the patient to survive. Then there are the second group, you could afford to wait until you complete the intensive phase. There's probably a third group that you would initiate ART at the end of TB treatment. I was just wondering about what guidelines you followed in order to kind of initiate the ART according to those three levels. The last thing is about your collaboration with your ART counterparts. Our TB sites are registered. I'm not too sure whether in this pilot you kind of coordinated with your ART counterparts to kind of register the TB site as an ART site. And maybe I'm just wondering whether there was a complementary initiation the other side so that we can initiate a TB treatment in our ART clinics. Thank you.
Thank you. With regard to the guidelines, we are following our national guidelines. As you can see there, patients below 200, they should start ART as early as possible, maybe within 2 weeks. And also those ones with CD4 to 350 to 200, they should wait at least intensive phase. And those ones above 350, they can be evaluated after TB treatment. So this is the guideline we are following. But as you can see from our data, it's only even in the ART, TB ART providing in TB clinic is only 42%. And if you look at this, maybe 85% of our patients would have been eligible for that. And this is partly reluctance from doctors, and maybe it's true because people don't know really what is the best time to initiate this, and TB heart studies which are conducted would provide us with answers, but also due to the patient factors. With regard to the starting similar approach in the CTC, I'm not sure if that, we haven't started really, and I'm not sure whether that would be the best to do that. But I know in one clinic where we are providing ART because they don't have many CTC, these care and treatment clinics, they've decided that the TB clinic would also provide ARV, but they alternate days. So like Monday will be TB and Tuesday will be for CTC, for purely HIV patients, not TB HIV. So they use the same building, but they alternate days because of issues of infection control and others.
I have noted you. I'll come. My sister from Zambia. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, such a brilliant presentation, raising up the pragmatic issues. I'm Felix San from Fontaine CV. The area you just presented is really very pertinent because I was even following up yesterday with Joseph. He made a similar presentation, but I think you have made a mile further because you have actually demonstrated starting ART in the, within the TB clinic. There are three things I would want to raise. The first one is the issue of infection control measure, and you ended up by putting a question mark. You are not the only one. I think this is the third time within these, the last 3 days, a similar presentation. So we have a problem there. And what I was putting forward was whether who could be advised, and throwing this to broader aspect, including people like Dr. Miller, advice on what is the scope of transmission within these confounded areas. In as much as we know from literature, that tells us that when patients are on TB treatment, you know, past a certain period, they should be non-infectious. And in the African setting, there is this big problem. And other than thinking of changing the whole infrastructure, is there anything that could be done, that we should be thinking, or how do we measure this? Because that is posing a very big problem. And then the second, partially maybe preempted, is the, you posed as a major, as one of the challenges, coordination and harmonization, but you didn't elaborate what this was like. You gave me the impression that this was well and rosy going on. What are the issues that have to do with the coordination, or rather challenges, because they always come almost in TB and HIV issues, but what are the specific issues in here? Then the last one is just on this slide, you have stated the reasons for delays for people starting on ART, and one of them is the first one, the doctor's reluctance. I can imagine, or my assumption is, as you've said, there are standard guidelines. Are these guidelines simply ignored by doctors, or, you know, how does it happen that you should resort to, you know, doctors should be reluctant in, you know, initiating treatment? Thank you.
Dr. Ndwara, can you keep note of the questions from Prof? So when we start discussing, you can address it, because we don't have much time. Also, you take note of the question from, can we have your question? You talk not, but address when we have a discussion.
Thank you very much for the excellent presentation. My questions are two. One of them is also on infection control. I was wondering whether you were thinking about the sputum positive patients versus the sputum negative patients and the opportunities for separation when treating them for their HIV infection, and then the follow-on care when they have been cured. Are they being referred to an HIV site independent of your site? And are you looking at adherence and follow-up care after that as well, whether they'll continue the ARVs? Thank you.
Okay, so take note of that, and don't forget to address that when we come to discussion. But I also, I think probably during discussion, I'll ask Dr. Miller to address that, because you find quite a lot of things that are pointing to TB infection. So probably you may guide us as the chairperson of this subgroup. So you probably will give you a few minutes to address us. Probably you may answer all our questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Ronwalo. Our next presenter is Dr. Sandy Gove. Dr. Gove is with WHO in the HIV department. She's a medical officer and team lead for the IMAI team.
Thank you, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about the decentralization of HIV prevention care and treatment to primary health center level. And what I'm going to try to do in this talk is to talk about that decentralization, but in the context of how that can improve the delivery of HIV services for the TB patients that are often already cared for at the health center level. And I'm giving this presentation on behalf of the IMAI team, IMAI's Integrated Management of Adolescent and Adult Illness. We're in the WHO Department of HIV/AIDS, but we collaborate with multiple WHO departments, and particularly in the tools I'm talking about today with the Stop TB department, as well as with the regional and country offices and many partners. some of whom I see in the audience. So this is on their behalf. And what we're talking about in terms of decentralization is trying to move services that have mostly within, you know, a few years ago from the central and regional hospitals down to the district hospital and from there to health centers for primary care delivery close to the home and to further community-based care. And the reasons for that, I think, are obvious for equity, access, and adherence. And decentralization, we're finding in many countries, is often happening in what we'd call a second phase. As countries become confident in the use of ART, they feel they can now move from central and regional hospitals and centers of excellence. They're also realizing that they have very large patient numbers when they can find treatment to those sites, things that we begin to call mega sites, where there's 2, 3, we've even heard of 4, 5, 6,000 patient sites that are really, really huge. Many ministries of health now want to expand to the district hospital and health center level. They feel the need for a more equitable distribution of ART services to serve more patients closer to home for greater equity and adherence in the long term. And so what we're seeing now in some countries is very rapid decentralization to health center level. Ethiopia to like 300 or 400 health centers. Tanzania is aiming at 1,000 health centers. Lesotho and Swaziland have already gone to a large number. Guyana, Namibia, et cetera. So it's a phenomenon that's happening in many places, and we've been trying to prepare tools and to work with countries and to build on experience such as the one that was just presented from Tanzania in order to help facilitate safe decentralization of services. And there's clear benefits. We need to either avoid these huge hospital mega clinics or reduce the numbers by down referral. And we know that in some sites that too many patients can lead to deteriorating care. In some sites, people are really lined up 300, 400, as has been mentioned here and in other presentations, in a day, getting very little counseling. There's more and more places experiencing significant loss to follow-up from hospital sites. And overall, there's a feeling that these huge clinics are actually perhaps impairing the health system rather than strengthening it. Improving access is really important, and one of the advantages that we hope to see, and I think has begun to be demonstrated in some places, is that if you're closer to home, patients don't wait so long as they would for going to a hospital, so that we're able to initiate ART earlier in less sick patients, and that we know means they're easier to manage and there's lower mortality. It's also, this is chronic care, so chronic care needs to be closer to the home. Over time, we can have better adherence, and it's obviously less expensive to the patient and family. And as the last presentation demonstrated, one-stop shop or single-site provision of HIV care to TB patients is very much welcomed by the patients, particularly as you're going to health center level. You have a small health center team. They're doing TB if they're going to do HIV care, treatment and prevention. It's usually the same people. And often it's the HIV services at a health center level being added to existing services that already address TB, maternal and child health, and EPI. So usually HIV in the range of services other than VCT is the new one that's coming in. And then the benefits of decentralization is it's easier to have true community-based care and to give the strong role needed to people living with HIV to do proper outreach to most at-risk populations and to take advantage, as the first presentation showed, of linking ART activities with TB treatment support and building on the strong DOT systems in some locations. So expanding capacity by decentralizing involves both going down to health center level with HIV care, ART, and prevention from a district hospital, but also within the district hospital. The example, I think, in Tanzania is within a hospital setting or large town to be able to move some of the services to TB clinics. And that's why we worked with STOP-TB to develop tuberculosis care with TB-HIV co-management, a guideline module that can help support that kind of co-management. And we've also worked on comparable materials to be able to support the lateral move and the decentralization of ART into antenatal clinics. And all of this requires, to support co-management, that there be co-supervision and co-sponsorship. But to do this, there's obviously key challenges, and we need to meet those challenges, and I'll try to summarize some of the ways that we've been working with partners to make sure that those challenges are met. One is that TB-HIV co-management is a clinical challenge. There's complicated TB-HIV patients. TB-ART co-treatment is not simple, and you need to have backup to support clinical decision-making by health-centric clinical teams. The second are the human resource challenges. There's less clinical expertise. Usually there's no doctors or medical officers or the capacity to hire on additionally as you're going down to health-center level. And most health centers start out understaffed to begin with. Going to many smaller sites is good for a lot of reasons, but it also means that you have a huge headache with all of these sites. You know, many people are now saying, yeah, that's great, but it's logistically and managerially challenging to go from, in some countries where they may be up to 50 to 100 sites, and imagining that they're going to go to 500 to 1,000, heading towards universal access. And that brings up the big question of how do we do this maintaining quality in such a large decentralization and scale-up. So I'm going to briefly go through, and I hope it's not too rushed, for the clinical challenge of TB-HIV co-management to talk about simplified operationalized guidelines that can support this kind of care at the health center level and how to support the district network. For HR challenges, task shifting to nurse-led clinical teams and expanding the team with PLHIV lay providers and community service. For the many smaller sites and those huge management and logistical challenges, there's an operations manual that's been developed to try to systematically support going down to health center level and the strengthening of the district management team. And in terms of how to maintain quality, quality management approaches, and at its backbone, an interlinked TB-HIV patient monitoring set of systems. So in terms of the clinical challenge of TB-HIV co-management, we've worked on providing simplified and operationalized guidelines, both for chronic HIV care, for acute care, so that we know health workers know how to suspect TB, how to do provider-initiated testing and counseling, and how to manage the complications of HIV and TB that come up during chronic HIV care and ART. And then a TB care with TB-HIV co-management guideline that supports both standard TB treatment but also co-management, including, based on a district clinician's treatment plan, TB-ART co-treatment. And all of that builds on the Stop TB department's basic TB first-level facility case management guidelines. And we feel an integrated approach can avoid the demands that, at this level, health workers try to combine separate tools from multiple disease programs. We have enough trouble doing it in expert working groups to try to make a coherent case management plan, and it's a little hard to ask health workers to do that. We also know that integration of prevention with treatment and care can support more consistent delivery of preventive interventions, and we feel that's crucial to any of the HIV services that we provide. So these guideline modules, they're all based on WHO normative guidelines. So many of you are in expert groups that have contributed to those that normative guidance, and we're basically working on simplifying and operationalizing that so that lower-level health workers are able to use this. They're integrated tools, and they serve both as learning and job aids. And I think this, the TB-HIV co-management guideline module is available at the TB booth, or was, or I think there's at least French versions left. The other aspect is really emphasizing that these teams aren't going to go alone at a health center level in trying to deliver services. They need to be supported within a district network. And the approach that we've been seeing effective, we'd call it a facility-community hybrid, where there's a hospital with satellite health centers and community-based care, linking facility and community interventions and supporting a nurse-led clinical team that's able to consult with a district clinician or referrer, all using the same patient monitoring system, which is a background, and trying to do this in an integrated fashion. So we're not talking about parallel systems, but integrated HIV services. And to do this, the clinical challenge of TB-HIV co-managed, we don't think can be met unless there's the ability to consult and refer when problems arise, particularly with teams with less clinical expertise. Clinical mentoring support is crucial. There needs to be access to communication by phone, often, in order to handle the toxicity, OI problems, iris, and complicated TB-HIV patient problems. And this all calls for systematic support, which we believe should actually be done on a national basis for clinical mentoring systems over time with trained clinical mentors. And we've tried to help with that with other partners, convening some consultations to put together some multi-partner clinical mentoring guidelines, as well as a pocket guide for mentors and training courses. And so, again, we talk always about these several levels of care and the need between them for referral and back referral, clinical mentoring, and supervision by the district HIV and TB management teams. In terms of the HR challenges, task shifting is obviously intrinsic to the approach that we're talking about, and it's task shifting not only from the doctors or health officers to the nurses, and laterally from an HIV clinic to TB clinic nurses and midwives and MCH nurses, but also going down some of their tasks to nursing assistants, to counselors, involving lay counselors on the clinical team. And probably the most important task shift down to the PLHIV themselves for self-management and to have support for family caregivers, as well as hiring and paying, we think, community health workers and other community-based practitioners. So task shifting for both HIV and TB services is important. It's been going on for decades in TB. It's been going on for a long time in child health. In HIV services, it's been important from the very beginning. And all of this requires, if you're going to task shift, to have effective training and strong follow-up after training to assure consistent application of standardized guidelines. So we believe that training needs to be skills-based. We avoid at the lower level PowerPoint presentations. We really try to have people get experience interacting with PLHIV expert patient trainers. And we found that actually, whereas when we started scale-up, we thought that training was the bottleneck, that in fact you can do rapid scale-up training. It's feasible. You can do continuous back-to-back training of multiple clinical teams over weeks. The real challenge is clinical mentoring and on-site support after training and having that done consistently at all sites. And this is just some of the training courses that we've supported where we actually separate the cotters and train people both in chronic HIV care, acute care, provider-initiated testing and counseling, and then short courses in TB-HIV co-management and TB infection control. And then a whole other set of courses that can be done in follow-on. One of the things that we've emphasized in training is to use people living with HIV as what we call expert patient trainers, and then promoting that they be able to be trained further to actually join the clinical team as lay providers. And we think this is crucial. There are about half of the faculty in many countries for scale up. They present cases, they give feedback during skill stations, mostly replacing role plays. They participate in classroom discussions. Now more than 20 countries have used them successfully, and we have a full curriculum. They're usually literate patients on ART, and they later, in many places, are incorporated on the clinical team. And I want to briefly just mention some experience from Tamil Nadu in India, from Sati, that was presented in Mexico, of using PLHIV trainers. And this was in the context of really pervasive stigma and discrimination that had historically limited access of people living with HIV to healthcare providers, especially in peripheral facilities in rural areas. So the pilot of IMEI was actually done in a rural area, and 61 people living with HIV were recruited. They got a two-day training. They then participated in training courses and trained a large number of doctors, nurses, counselors, and lab techs. And post-training, they continued on. They were under short-term contracts. They continued to visit peripheral health facilities to see how care was being offered and continued to network with healthcare providers. They actually signed a pledge to access treatment services and promote health care-seeking behavior of their peers. And they motivated their peers to seek routine care. So they went back out into the community, and they promoted, and this is in just a couple catchment areas, a significant number of people who had never been in contact with health services before to actually be tested and go to the primary health centers. And in that, they enhanced not only testing but also TB services, found TB patients in the community that were previously unconnected with care, and got people that were known to be HIV positive tested with CD4. And the healthcare providers reported that the rapport that they built with the patient, with these expert patient trainers during their training, actually got them to overcome what was originally their own unwillingness in some cases to actually take care of people living with HIV. There's a lot of stigma there at the beginning, and they found that this kind of personal interaction made a large difference to that. And of all the people with HIV that previously had not attended clinic that were brought in by the EPTs, all of them reported having received treatment without hesitation from the providers, and they were quite pleased with the care they got. And so it's all contributed to a much larger patient enrollment in that network. In terms of management and logistics, going to these many smaller sites, it's really important that we have figure out ways, and I think this is the most challenging, to really get collaboration between the national programs, between the national programs and their regional representations, and at district level, between TB and HIV. Because to have TB-HIV co-management at the health center level really requires that you have both co-supervision and hopefully ultimately co-sponsorship of these activities. So that when TB treatment is provided at a health center, that's obviously overseen by the district TB coordinator, but when HIV care and ART is provided with TB treatment, that's overseen by the district HIV coordinator. They need to have ways that they can effectively work together. And we found that in discussions that it's easier at the district level than it is at the regional or national level. And I think that's something that globally we need to seriously encourage. One thing we've been trying to do in a collaboration with PEPFAR and other partners is to provide some tools to strengthen the management and logistics support for decentralization. So there's a draft operations manual that was prepared with CDC USAID and a cast of 250 experts from various implementing partners and other agencies. And that deals a lot with management and leadership, infrastructure, supply management, lab services, integration and linkages of services, patient and program monitoring, and quality management. And this is a full draft that's now out for second phase review, and we all continue to welcome input into it. We also have tools to really try to support district management. There's already a district HIV coordinators course. There's been discussions about way we can fit together and have the TB district management and the HIV district management fit together better, and then national and regional tools to support this kind of collaboration. And again, the operations manual really is meant, it's on the management and logistics side. So we found that clinical guidelines and support simply aren't enough to really support scale up at health center level, that we need to have this type of support. And throughout management and logistics, the operations manual, TB-HIV and TB infection control are integrated. And this is just one example of the logistics support, for instance, to clinical mentoring. Good distance communication is essential, so we need to have a way and to systematically figure out how can the health center team call the clinical mentor if he's part of their time. Do we revise use of landlines? Do we have some solution to mobile cell phones? Or is there even places where they can use satellite systems that are often in other sectors? And the last one, within all this, how do we maintain quality? And this is a huge challenge and something that we've tried to thoroughly integrate and emphasize more and more. And in the operations manual, we say the quality of care really has three fundamental aspects, that the patients receive the care they need, that that care is delivered consistent with national guidelines, and it has the desired positive effect on patient health and well-being. And that improvements in quality don't take a special additional system, that you can do it without additional resources. Everybody has to feel they have a responsibility from quality from national to individual level, and that it's affected by multiple factors, leadership, infrastructure, training, available resources, and very importantly, that the client and community perspective is an important part of quality. Issues that may be important in that regard to monitor, such as waiting time, cleanliness, and staff attitude to people living with HIV. So when in the draft operations manual and accompanying district management documents, we have a varied and combined quality management approach. We feel the patient and program monitoring systems are at the base of it, that clinical mentoring is important for quality management, supportive supervision by district management teams. There's also an approach there that we want to see get some more experience with, called the five S's for work environment improvement, sorting the essential from the unnecessary and unused, setting items in a proper order, shining, maintaining cleanliness, standardizing this approach, and then sustaining it. And that's a non-quantitative approach to quality management. And then, obviously, quality improvement is a core approach. We have a simplified quality improvement approach that's been done collaboratively with a number of quality improvement groups for health center level that we want to get more experience with. And then obviously for lab and pharmacy, there's special quality systems needed for decentralization of integrated services, as well as leadership and management support. And at the base of this quality approach is these interlinked patient monitoring systems, and we've just completed a consultation and about a two-year process of developing a way that we could take. We have the updated TB patient monitoring system, the recording and reporting forms that were finalized with HIV variables in 2006. And we've expanded the HIV care ART monitoring system so that we can better measure things like TB status checked on the last visit, TB ART co-treatment, INH given in pre-ART care. So all of that should be able now to work together well between these several systems of care. Rather than having two separate systems, we can actually say at a health center level or in a clinic that's delivering both services that this is something that can work next to each other. And so it can support the co-management and co-supervision of combined HIV, TB, pregnancy, and child care. And we think this is important, a key way of monitoring indicators of quality of care. And just to show briefly, this may seem like a lot of things, but this actually condenses things from what's almost there normally. By putting together MCH and PMTCT into the same antenatal and labor and delivery record register, we actually often reduce things that often were handled before as projects. So what the strong TB system to which we're adding links, you know, already had the HIV variables have been added. Now the HIV care ART system is thoroughly linked in a way that we think will, in time, be able to let us really prove that we're achieving the quality of care that we want. So I think I'll stop now. I think I've probably gone over time, but thank you very much.
Okay. I think we have time for two quick clarification questions, if there are any. Otherwise, I'll ask you to please hold your longer questions to the end for more discussion.
I just had one quick question. It's all very impressive and I'm sure very effective. I just had a question about the compliance to HIV therapy in the satellite clinics, because as you know, if patients are not compliant, stop and start their medicine, they can often develop resistance. Mm-hmm. And also, do you have any idea about viral resistance in any of these areas, baseline or after therapy?
In terms of viral resistance data, we don't have it. There is some early data from Ethiopia and one other country that the adherence to treatment and loss to follow-up is actually lower in the health center-based clinics than in the large hospital-based. But, I mean, that actually makes a lot of sense because they have less distance to go. But we don't have the drug resistance data.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, our next presenter is Dr. Sirinapa Chittamane. Dr. Chittamane is with the Ministry of Health in Thailand and the TB Bureau and is a public health officer.
Good morning, and thank you so much for the opportunity to Thailand to share the experience in implementing TB issue activities. And yesterday, I was presenting some of these topics, and some of the participants came to ask me because I'm a program staff member. So we work as a program implementation rather than the project based. So they asked, was it difficult at the beginning in Thailand when we implement these activities? And my answer is yes, because TB activities is not a solo program. We need a lot of collaborations from the National AIDS program. But at the beginning, it was difficult. But when we have a good relationship with them, and then they become a strong supporter for the TBHV activities. And I will present about the barriers for the uptake of HIV testing and the ART. Some of the barriers have been solved, but some remain challenges, especially the ART, which may be similar to other countries right now. And these are the background where Thailand is now. Thailand is the country with HIV epidemic, and HIV infection in pregnant women in 2007 was about 0.9%. And TB HIV therapies has been implemented countrywide just in 2 years ago. And we have the policy where we want to achieve, but in practice, each hospital implement these activities with a big variation, and I'll show you how the variation among these hospitals is. And that's why we need to evaluate the barriers of the uptake of HIV testing and ART, because we need to improve the quality of care. Since at the beginning of the implementation, we could not achieve the target we want to go. Thailand is setting the targets, which is the consensus agreement that all hospitals need to achieve. And I'll show you only some of the targets which is related to the presentation today. For the HIV testing, we have the agreement that all TB patients need to be offered HIV testing and counseling at the beginning of the diagnosis. And in 2006, the target was 75% and then increased. And right now, the target is about 85%. And for ART, we use the criteria for CD4 less than 250. And the patients need to, the eligible patients need to start ART during the intensive phase. So we set the target in 2006 was about 50% and increased in the later year. These targets have been changed twice, because when we start the program, we set the targets were very ambitious, and we found that we couldn't reach that one, and we learned that we need to adjust the target. And now here is the current one, which we use in the country. And when we first implementing the TBHIV activities, we found that we could not achieve several activities. So we identify what are the barriers we need to reduce, so that could help improve the program. The method to evaluate the barriers, we use the routine reporting system, which is the TBHIV report we collect from our hospitals every 3 months. And from this data, we could identify which area has a strong or weak program. And then we identify the specific characteristics from a specific survey to identify the strengths and weaknesses of the area implementing TBHIV activities. And this is the routine report which all hospitals in Thailand report to the to the TB program. There are two parts, but I just show you the first part, which TB clinic staff collect the primary data and report to the provincial health office. And this is the flow of the information. In Thailand, there are about 847 public hospitals under the Ministry of Public Health, and then they submit the paper-based report to the Provincial Health Office 1 month after each quarter ends, and then each Provincial Health Office collect the hospitals under their responsibility, submit to the regional level, which is the Office of Disease Prevention and Control, and then the Office of Disease Prevention and Control submit to the TB Bureau, which I work. And after we use the routine report, we did a specific survey on HIV testing and counseling, and we include only major topics, which are the hospital written policy about HIV testing and counseling, and the criteria which the doctors order the HIV testing, and who provide HIV testing and counseling, HIV clinic staff or TB clinic staff, and the time period to offer the HIV counseling and testing, and where the patient receive this HIV testing and counseling, and the last one, the counseling procedure. As I think most of you are aware that provider initiate HIV testing and counseling, and client initiate the process of both procedures are different, especially for the PITC, is not include the risk assessment. So we want to make sure that what's going on at the practice level. And the same, we did the survey on the ART services in a demonstration hospitals and asked the similar topics, because we believe that these are would be major barriers for the ART uptake. We asked them to provide the criteria for the ART for TB patients, and who provide the ART for TB HIV patients, and when they provide, and where. And we also add one question about the doctor for perception on ART, because we do know that they are reluctant to start ART for TB patients, and we just need to have valid information how strong about this one. And for the specific survey we did in demonstration hospitals, which are sponsored by the Thailand MOPH US CDC collaborations, and try to use the arrow here, okay. And from the graph, these are the geographic distribution where the hospitals are, because in Thailand, the HIV epidemic is a little bit different, especially in the north. The HIV epidemic is very high, so we try to include representative across the country. And from the baseline survey in 15 hospitals, before we start the interventions in this hospital, we found that 14 hospitals did not have the written policy. The Ministry of Health has the written policy, but at the practice level, sometimes they need to inform their own staff. But 14 hospitals did not have this one. And the criteria for HIV testing and counseling, almost hospitals, they offer HIV testing and counseling only for TB patients with the risk behavior, or some patients show signs and symptoms related to HIV infection. And for the staff, 12 hospitals have the HIV clinic staff to provide HIV counseling for TB patients, and they wait until the end of intensive phase to offer the HIV counseling, because they want the patients to cannot spread TB germs to the counselor. And the place, they use the HIV clinic to offer to provide HIV counseling for TB patients, and use the voluntary counseling to as a process for the HIV counseling and testing for TB patients. And at the beginning, I'll show you the baseline information among these 15 hospitals. We found that we found some barriers of this one, and we need to minimize it, because we need to improve the quality of care through the HIV testing and counseling. So we work with these hospitals to do the written policy at the hospital level, and develop the consensus agreement endorsed by the hospital director that HIV testing counseling should be offered for all TB patients after TB diagnosis. And we developed a counseling handbook for them, and we provide counseling training for TB clinic and HIV clinic staff because for the PITC, TB clinic staff provide a pre-test counseling and post-test counseling for HIV negative. But for the HIV positive, we need to have HIV clinic staff to do this at the TB clinic because TB clinic staff have less experience in providing post-test counseling for HIV positive clients. And we start providing PITC at the TB clinic because of the infection control issues. And we also do the review the case studies because some patients, they are they refuse HIV testing, and we need to learn from these cases how we can improve our quality of care. And then we do the regular feedbacks to the hospitals where the target is and how the hospital could achieve of these activities. And some of this work have been published in the IJTLD this year, and you can review that if you are interested. And this is the handbook we use. HIV knowledge is has changed all the time. We use the term diagnostic counseling and testing in 2006, and we developed that guideline. We translate from the USCDC curriculum and modify to fit into our health infrastructure. And then in 2007, May 2007, I think PITC handbook came out by WHO and UNS, and we follow that recommendation and adjust our guideline and just publish the new one this year. The handbook is very important to guide the TB and HIV clinic staff because for the pre-test, this handbook also provides a sample script that the TB clinic staff with less experience in provide pre-test counseling can follow. And we have the checklist, the important topics they need to explain to the patients, including the post-test counseling, which topics they need to include. So, for, and we also include the case studies because as some of you may have experience in providing pre-test counseling for TB patients, because TB patients, they do not expect to have an HIV testing at all when they come to the TB clinic. They always negotiate and they ask, I'm single, I'm a student, I never married, why I need to have an HIV testing? So we need to prepare our staff about this issue. And we have the different lessons learned, and this book, we train them like 3 days and prepare them what situation they will face and what they could do if they have these things. And during the training, all hospitals need to come with the HIV clinic staff because when TB clinic staff could not do the HIV pre-test, something like that, the TB, HIV clinic staff can help the TB clinic. And we also develop the brochures to inform TB patients because most TB patients, they need to wait in the waiting area. And then even though some of them could not read, but they have, if for the elderly, they have the relatives with them and they can be informed in advance what they will discuss with the doctors because doctors will tell the patients about the HIV testing too. And you can see that we concern a lot about the infection control, and we use the private area with the good ventilation. And you can see that for this lady, she is like 82 years old, and she asks, my husband died 20 years ago, and I do not married, so why I need to have an HIV testing? Something like that. And you can see the different challenges when you provide a pre-test counseling. So we prepare our staff, and then years later, I'll show you the results, how we could reduce these barriers. And this from the demonstration hospitals, which the TB Bureau work directly with these hospitals because we need a lot of primary information from them. These hospitals are tertiary hospitals. They have the most complex system with the huge case load. So we believe that if we could help these hospitals, so the community hospitals would be learn from them. And at the beginning, before we start the program, they could achieve the HIV testing only 57%. And then it has increased all the time. And in the last, in the recent one, okay, so it reached almost 90%. We didn't pay anything for them. This is the program base. We just have more communications with them. And the country target for 208 is 85. So from this hospital, we reduce the barriers and the routine practice can use experience from this one to improve the practice. And this is the program-based result, which we use the country budget. And we need to see the green map, because the green map means that we achieve the country target. And you can see that we have more and more for the HIV testing in Thailand, but some are red, so we need to work with them. And for the ART, which is more difficult when compared to the HIV testing, and we did the survey in our demonstration hospitals, and you can see the variation from hospitals to hospitals. For criteria to start ART before we start the intervention, 12 hospitals use the CD4 less than 200, while 3 hospitals are less than 250. And because the National AIDS Program used to recommend CD4 less than 200, but the TB program recommend 250. So after these findings, we came back and organized a meeting with the National AIDS Program to consensus. We need to have only one recommendation for the hospital. So eventually this one has been solved. We used the CD4 for less than 250. And we learned that all hospitals have the HIV clinic staff to provide ART for TB HIV patients. And most, they wait to start ART after TB treatment. And they provide ART treatment at the HIV clinic, and the doctor report that they are reluctant to start ART because of the complexity of the TB and HIV treatment. And these are the baseline ART results in the hospitals, in the 15 hospitals. It's between 40%. We need to increase this hospital to 60%, and now we started interventions, but I couldn't show you the finding yet. And these are the routine based results, and you can see that we need to see the same thing, more green map. And in Thailand right now, this is the first quarter of fiscal year 2008. We can count only 6 provinces achieve the ART for TB patients, and you see a lot of red provinces here. So we have a long way to go to help our patients here. And now we start interventions to reduce the barriers of ART for TB HIV patients. We had a meeting with the National AIDS Program to develop the written consensus agreement, and then now it has been endorsed by the Department of Disease Control. to emphasize that the criteria to start ART use the CD4 less than 250 and start ART during the intensive phase. And we provide ART training for hospital staff, for doctors and nurses from both TB and HIV clinic. And we start supervision by the HIV program staff because from the Thailand perspective, we want to use the existing system rather than create a parallel system. The ART system is there. We need to integrate it, our services into the existing system. So the HIV staff, the HIV network are there. We just talk to them and ask them, here is the problems and this is our solutions and how they can help us. And the last one, we found that maybe similar to the previous presentation, the doctors need a lot of support from the experts or mentors. They can call if they have their patients with the drug toxicities, how they can do that if they have this system. They are comfortable to start ART for TB patients. And in the upper picture, here is the ART mentor from the National AIDS program. And most HIV doctors, he can influence the HIV doctors to start ART, and then they can call him. So we hope that we could report a higher ARV uptake after these interventions. And the bottom one, we do the case review with the HIV program staff, because in some hospitals which are the low ART uptake, so we went there and reviewed the HIV register, patient medical charts with the HIV program and show them what's going on, and then they learn more and more because the HIV clinic staff belongs to the HIV program. So now they see the results of after these activities. So this is the conclusions, what we learned 2 years in experience. We use the regular reports and specific survey to identify the barriers, because otherwise we could not improve the program efficiently. And the most common barriers for HIV testing are the lack of hospital written policy and the provision of HIV counseling and testing outside TB clinic, and the use of client initiative HIV testing and counseling. Because from this perspective, when we do the risk assessment, when the patient did not have anything, so they do not have a reason why they need to have an HIV testing. And the third one, to minimize the barriers, now in Thailand, we could achieve the minimizing barriers because the HIV testing in Thailand start increasing. And the last one, provider barriers for ART uptake is very important because they perceive the complexity of TB and ART treatment in the same time. So we need to, I agree with the clinical mentoring because they request this when we ask them what the program can help them. And we have a lot of technical assistance from the Thailand Ministry of Public Health and US CDC collaborations for implementing the demonstration project and training materials, and including the written document, and for the World Health Organization to help the country for the pilot projects and external evaluation about the TB HIV activities. And I would like to acknowledge Dr. Somsak, Dr. Yutichai, Dr. Sivapan, and she is here, and they are my supervisors and my administrators for my work. and Dr. J. Varmar from USCDC, Dr. Puniti Warren from the WHO Sierra to help us with a difficult area. And the last one for the TB clinic and HIV clinic staff in the demonstrating hospitals, they teach us a lot how we can improve the program. And this is my last slide. And this is the lowest hospitals, which is the ART HIV testing is available here. Thank you. This is
thank you for that presentation. If there are one or two quick questions for clarification, we can take them now. Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. And we'll move on to our final presenter. Our final presenter is Dr. Mary Lou Lindgren. Dr. Lindgren is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta in the HIV Care and Treatment Branch in the Global AIDS Program, and she'll be providing an overview of recent WHO guidelines on essential HIV care and prevention interventions that should be applied in all settings, including TB clinical settings.
How come these aren't coming up? I can't get them to come up. Do you know how to get them to come up?
I don't. Is there an IT person in the room that can help with this presentation loading?
I'm going to try to be quick because I know you all want to have a nice discussion, but I was asked to, thankfully, by Monita to fill in for the Uganda presentation that was going to highlight the basic care package in TB settings. I think it's a really important concept, and we also, so we want to highlight for you recent WHO guidelines that outline the essential HIV prevention and care interventions for adults and adolescents living with HIV in resource-limited settings. I don't know, Juanita, is there any way to get somebody to help with these slides?
Yeah, there's an IT person that is, coming around.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So basically, thank you. Basically, what these guidelines cover, they were published in August 2008, and they cover both prevention of HIV transmission, which there's actually a concurrent session going on concerning positive prevention with HIV-positive people, and prevention of morbidity and mortality. So care interventions are presented in this document. And this is really a what-to-do document rather than a how-to-do-it. They convened, WHO convened expert consultation in June of 2006, and we were able to come up and prioritize 13 areas. And I'm going to go through each of these.
Can you try it now and see if that works?
Okay.
Let's just click it once and see what that does.
So anyway, what I'll just keep going, and this is no problem. I've memorized these. The first, really, to have a complete set of guidelines, we did reiterate previously published guidelines, and cotrimoxazole is obviously one of the most important interventions that many of you have mentioned, but we want to reiterate the scale-up of cotrimoxazole for HIV-infected individuals. There's been a lot of emphasis in this session on provision of ART for your HIV-TB patients. But all HIV-infected individuals really need access to these essential care interventions to really prolong life, and cotrimoxazole is one of those. And, of course, as you know, it reduces morbidity and mortality. And so the cotrimoxazole guidelines are included in these. The second, I really don't know why it's not coming up. The second one that is very important are safe water interventions. And so the Uganda presentation that Donna Kabatesi was going to make has a basic care package that includes the safe water intervention. And, of course, this includes point of use as a household intervention with chlorination is one of the evidence-based interventions. And there are several other flocculation disinfectant these interventions are often given at the HIV care and treatment sites and could be given at the TB settings along with cotrimoxazole. So that is our second intervention I wanted to highlight. The third is prevention of malaria. And, of course, malaria, there's an increased risk of malaria in HIV-infected persons. And there's also potential for increased morbidity, particularly among those with advanced immunosuppression. And so the three interventions for malaria that we have in these guidelines are, of course, insecticide-treated bed nets. And also, cotrimoxazole is very effective in preventing malaria. And so in terms of a basic care intervention, the distribution of insecticide-treated nets to HIV-infected patients in their households is a very important and strongly recommended intervention. And so that's another part of our guidelines. Now, for pregnant women, if they're on cotrimoxazole, this is a very important intervention. But for those who are not, the recommendations are for intermittent, we call it IPT with a little p. So it's not to be confused with the TB intervention. But this is very important to prevent placental malaria. So again, cotrimoxazole, malaria. Oh, great. Ah, okay, this is the last presentation, and it's better than the Eiffel Tower going last night, blinking and blinking. This is very similar. Okay. This is a way to end the session. And now we're, okay. So we've gone on from malaria now into the nutrition intervention. So included in these, and I think this is a very important point, is we have an opportunity to do nutritional assessments. And, of course, there are in this document, we combined other WHO recommendations just to make this comprehensive. But in terms of nutrition, there's an absolute need for nutritional assessment and nutritional support. So the recommendations include for those individuals who meet the criteria to make sure that they have access to supplemental feeding if their BMIs are between 16 and 18, or therapeutic feeding if they're less than 16.5. And of course, the other important part of this is access to household food security. So I think these are some of the main packages of care, and I didn't want to go too much into. We do have TB interventions in this essential care package, which, of course, are your three I's, intensified case finding, infection control, and IPT, which I'm not going to go into. But I think the most important, is it working now? Okay. So, oh, good. So this is really the bottom line here, our main interventions. And I'm just going to flip through this because I've already, I didn't even talk about, we did systematic reviews and whatnot. And these interventions were graded and by strength of recommendation. So I'm really just highlighting those where all the recommendations and the quality of the evidence were such that they should be followed. So I'm not going to review this again. This is just the background on the evidence for cotrimoxazole and the recommendations. We talked a bit about safe water and the reduction in diarrhea among HIV-infected people and the evidence-based safe water interventions. And, of course, I actually literally wrote down all of these specific recommendations, so when you eventually look at this on the website, we argued over every word, so there was no editing on these slides because every word actually means a great deal when we're talking about these kind of recommendations. So here we're highlighting the use of household-based water treatment methods, proper disposal of feces in a toilet latrine or at minimum buried in the ground, and again, promotion of hand washing and provision of soap. Malaria, again, I think I went over sort of the risk from HIV with malaria and the effective interventions. This is a very important slide to emphasize the importance of the combination of these interventions and the dramatic impact it can have on morbidity and mortality. So as you can see here, when cotrimoxazole and ART and NETs are provided sequentially, these are data from Uganda, the malaria risk is reduced by 76%. And then with all three interventions, you can see on the very last column, a reduction in 95% of malaria. So these are the actual recommendations regarding cotrimoxazole, regarding IPT little p, regarding distribution of bed nets to those people who are actually traveling to, who live in non-malarious areas but traveling to areas with malaria transmission. And here's the TB recommendations, which I'm going to flip through because you know them all. The next set of interventions, which are really our prevention of HIV transmission. And because you're not sitting in the other session that is like describing this, I think I would like to highlight a couple of these that are very important, and there's an opportunity to provide in HIV settings for your HIV, for your TB HIV patients. And the first one, of course, is offering HIV testing and counseling to partners of your TB HIV patients, and also support for disclosure to their partners and assessing really the safety of this disclosure and the consent of the individual. So, and the second we've spent a lot of time on is really making sure that these co-infected patients have access to comprehensive set of psychosocial interventions, so support, counseling, especially to discordant couples, and also for those individuals who have mental health conditions, including alcohol dependence, would have access to treatment and intervention. Again, more psychosocial interventions. This includes adherence interventions to support not only their therapeutic regimens, but also their prophylactic regimens, including cotrimoxazole. And, of course, provision of condoms and counseling regarding consistent use of condoms to prevent and avoid STIs and unintended pregnancy. Family planning is another area that should be provided to TB HIV patients, if not on site, then in terms of a referral. And this also includes the desires as women health improve, you know, to really talk to them about their desires for children, and that should also be part of the family planning, counseling, and services. Again, strongly emphasizing condoms in this setting as well. Finally, STI screening and management. There's a number of recommendations here, and I'm not going to go through them all, but they're a lot of text on this slide because you're going to get them on the website, and I want you to read them carefully or get this online at WHO's website. But again, we are emphasizing counseling regarding consistent condom use, particularly on most at-risk populations, in this case, sex workers, counseling about genital ulcers and genital herpes and the need, the increased risk of transmission. This is a busy slide, but at the bottom of this is really an assessment for STIs based on clinical history, and also laboratory screening, which is a serologic test for syphilis being recommended. And we're available. I just wanted to point out the opportunity for women with HIV to be screened for cervical cancer. So ongoing counseling on assessment of risk behaviors and STI symptoms, and of course, those who are found to have symptoms to be treated according to syndromic management, and also in areas of high prevalence of herpes, episodic acyclovir. So these are very important components of our positive prevention, and there's very good evidence for these interventions. They're, as you can see, they range from A, strongly recommended, 1, A2. These are how we grade evidence, meaning they come from randomized clinical trials or very high-quality observational studies. And finally, regarding injection drug users, there are recommendations and very strong evidence about that they should have ready access to needle syringe programs and opioid substitution therapy. So in summary, in brief, and sorry to just go through this really fast, but I really encourage you to think about how the basic HIV care package could be provided in your TB settings, and or how that patient, in addition to ART, might really take advantage of these life-saving interventions, cotrimoxazole, safe drinking water, malaria prevention, nutrition, and micronutrient supplementation, counseling and services to prevent HIV transmission, and testing and counseling of their partners and family members. So thank you for thinking about integration of HIV care into your TB settings. Please go online and read these interventions and share them with your countries, because this has recently come out, and it has a really, this is a great time to promote this in your clinical settings. Thank you.
So we're running a bit short on time. So at this point, I think I'm going to go ahead and just invite all five of our presenters to come up here as a panel, and we will take some questions and discussion.
Before we start having few questions, I'll just let Dr. Miller to make a statement, because I think we have had several questions about infection control. Probably has the solutions.
Yeah, right. Thanks very much, and I just wanted to make one or two comments based on the various questions given. First of all, we are having another symposium today beginning at 2 o'clock, and I think it will address a number of the questions that actually came up, both in terms of the fact that we've reviewed the literature and evidence base and that there's going to be a new policy coming out, which will be described, a lot of practical examples from the field, cost assessments, and so on. But I think the main question I heard is that in addition to policy and action plans and engineering controls that we are working on and an advocacy campaign, people are wondering how to get started right now in clinical settings. We have developed, in collaboration with the HIV department at WHO, a poster, 10 Essential Steps, and this is available on our infection control website, in the Stop TB website. And I guess I would emphasize a few very basic things that we can do starting tomorrow, including screening all comers to HIV clinical settings, ART programs, and so on, for TB at every visit, separating symptomatics, and that means another room outside when possible, or fast-tracking them to the front of the line, having waiting areas outside, and we've seen some slides today of that, assigning a special person who's looking after infection control. Often just thinking about it gets you started, and these are things you can really do very quickly. Windows open in the African setting, I think that is very possible. And attention to healthcare workers, which includes encouraging HIV testing. So come to our session this afternoon. We'll elaborate on this as well. We are, as part of the work group, going to be developing a package including fact sheets and basic approaches to facility assessment. But while we're waiting, we can actually get started. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miller. I think the symposium is in the same room, I think. Is it at 2 o'clock?
Yeah,
is this the one, the three I's?
No, it isn't. It's control of TB transmission in healthcare facilities,
okay.
Room 342AB.
Thank you very much. We remember that Dr. Ondolo has already two questions to answer, but can we take your question?
First, I'd like to thank all the speakers for bringing up this topic and discussing a very important issue. I basically had a question from my experience working with TB and HIV clinics in Kenya. A lot of the HIV clinics are funded and run largely in part by NGOs, and a lot of the NGOs will claim to be working in conjunction with the Ministry of Health, but ultimately it seems like a lot of the HIV clinics will have more funding, which results in the clinical and medical officers getting paid more than the clinical officers in the TB chest clinic. And what I've noticed is a lot of times there becomes this competition or resentment between the clinicians of the HIV clinic and the TB clinic. And ultimately that leads to poor communication and even different protocols that are being used for treatment, and when to initiate treatment, what treatment plans to use, and then that will lead to poor patient outcomes. So I just wanted to know, I guess anyone who has a specific experience, or perhaps Dr. Gove, if you could comment on possible solutions to overcoming this barrier of integrating HIV and TB care. Thank you.
Can you take that? question. Are you specifically asking direct to somebody or open?
It can be to anyone. Perhaps if Dr. Gove could comment on that.
I think one of the reasons that we're emphasizing heading towards building district networks and national systems is over time as we go to more and more sites, we need to build up district management teams and multiple clinical teams that work, I guess, on an equitable basis with a shared mentoring system. And I think that's something that national governments need help and they need to negotiate and to try to work these things out over time because, you know, the human resource challenges aren't made easier if there's a lot of movement between programs and between partner-supported sites. But we also have to realize that it's really good that we're having influx of a lot of partner support for sites. So I think this is something that partners need to work with the ministry over time to try to bring together. And while I have the microphone, I just wanted to add one thing about what we can do now on TB infection control, because in the TB care with TB HIV co-management materials that we showed on the slide, we actually have a summary of TB infection control in the operations manual. We've put these 10 essential steps, and there's a very short training course on what health workers can actually do in terms of prioritizing that people go to the front of the line, that there's rapid service, that we don't, you know, get too much exposure that's unnecessary. And I think that, you know, we can all get started in TB infection control right away. And some of these materials are actually outside if you want to look at them.
Hi, thanks. Anandate with Global AIDS Program, CDC Atlanta. I would like to ask our colleague from Kenya, Dr. Odhiambo. It was good to see that the activities at the community level, I mean, the issue came up even during the plenary, and Ambassador Mark Dibble stressed it, we cannot really control any disease unless if we stop at the health facility level, we need to go into the community. But we are talking about health systems, and then we are talking about disease-focused efforts. They do help in health strengthening. But I was thinking at community level, because you have these TB ambassadors, which is a welcome thing, but then we also have on the HIV side or other programs, you have community-based HIV care. So I was wondering, where is the overlap? Are you using these TB ambassadors on the other side, which is a comprehensive approach, not focusing on TB, HIV, but more comprehensive, also engaging them in HIV care? And then the second part to it is, I know Kenya has taken a big initiative implementing PWP, prevention with positives, as a national strategy. So what is the role going to be of these TB ambassadors in the implementation of PWPs? And in the interest of the audience, if you can briefly talk about these efforts of prevention with positives in Kenya. Thanks.
Thank you.
One clarification from our colleague from Thailand. I was wondering, you talked about hospitals, so I was wondering what happens below hospitals. I'm not aware of the healthcare systems in Thailand, but I was wondering, it is good to see high HIV testings and ART and CPT in hospitals, but it would be interesting to know what happens beyond the hospital levels at the lower healthcare facility levels.
Well, thank you very much. Maybe I'll start with your last question, prevention with positives. HIV is the main driving factor behind the TB epidemic in Kenya, and unless we control HIV, it will be difficult in the long run to control TB. And so we want to work comprehensively across all HIV care settings, including the TB clinics. And so the TB clinics are kind of taking leadership role in implementation of prevention with positives. Half of our TB patients are co-infected. So if we take the example of our numbers in 2007, Kenya registered 1,600 TB patients. Half of them were HIV positive. So it's only those who have HIV that can transmit it. So although some of our public health TB clinics are fairly overstretched in terms of space as well as staff hands, we think it is important to make a start, at least in those settings that can do the first step of disclosure. The index case who has TB, or rather has HIV and TB. We are doing what is called disclosure and testing of the partner as a major first step. So the TB program has adopted PWP as an official intervention in the TB setting. And so we are working out, we have finished training of staff across the country. In order to implement this, we have identified certain pilot sites because we didn't want to kind of initiate this in all at once. We needed to have first experience before bringing this to national scale. So we have factored in PWP variables in our TB registers. So part of our evaluation of how we move from testing the partner and offering the key interventions, which are ART, cotrimoxazole, condoms, advice on alcohol, family planning, and things like that, we hope to be able to share with Kenyans as well as the rest of the world how we are doing. The ultimate goal is that we have prevention activities around each HIV-positive TB patient. The second part of your question was to do with how we integrate our community TB activities with the HIV side. I think that is critical. In my presentation, I mentioned that the TB ambassadors actually escort our TB patients, to those who are co-infected, to the HIV clinic for care and treatment. That is an important responsibility. But to get the desired overlap with our HIV colleagues, we are taking as a priority the three I's in the next phase. So the entry point at that level will be an HIV-positive person in whom we want to screen for TB. So it's kind of a win-win situation, and we're going to be using the same community hands to do both. Obviously, there are challenges in terms of coordination of documentation and reporting, but the desire is there that we maximize on the hands to do both community HIV and TB activities. Thank you.
A quick answer from Thailand, then we finish with Dr. Ndola. You had two questions.
The question is, what activities are beyond the hospital level in Thailand? How can I say? We have the health centers under the hospitals, and we have the village health volunteers under the health centers. And for TB activities in Thailand, is less involved at the community level, but for the health centers, which they have at least two or three nurses there, and they help for the refer TB suspects to the hospital, do the home visits, and do the DOT. But for the village health volunteers, they have very, very, I mean, a few activities for the TB activities. Yeah. No, we provide HIV testing and counseling only at the hospital levels, not at the health centers.
Thank you. I had two questions. One was on infection control, which I think Dr. Mira has already answered that. And another one was on the harmonization and coordination with people from HIV. I think this is very critical. In our experience in Temeke, this clinic, before we started providing ART, it has to be accredited, just like any other CTC, by people from HIV services, because that was important because we need logistics, we need reagents, we need drugs. So if it's not officially recognized, then you run out of not having these services. Again, it's important also for coordination because you will need mentoring and supervision from HIV people because you have staff with very basic training at the TB clinic, but then you need people to be able to manage if there's complications, side effects, and you need people from HIV side. So it's very important to coordinate. Thank you.
Okay, and unfortunately we're over time, so we're going to have to cut the discussion short, but I encourage you to definitely follow up with the presenters if you have additional questions. Thanks to all five of our presenters for excellent presentations, and I think we've really been able to identify some of the barriers and challenges to linking patients to HIV care and treatment, and also offered some models and some approaches that can offer solutions. So thank you very much, and thank you all for your discussion and participation.
Yeah.